To give a little introduction to for the students who are new to the topic of aid effectiveness is that our purpose for this panel is to discuss various experiences and to generate ideas to improve the effectiveness of what we do. And this is based on the principles of the Paris Declaration. How many of you have heard about the Paris Declaration? Okay, pretty good. Okay. For those of you that did not raise your hands, don't worry. Just Google Paris Declaration and you will go to the OECD website, the Organization for Economic Development, and you will find a document that's about 4 or 5 pages long that summarizes the agreements of about 90 countries and a number of international bilateral organizations. They agreed on a number of principles to follow in order to demonstrate aid effectiveness and more accountability. You know how fragmented the field of global health is. Everybody has good intention, is trying to do their best, but we are all coordinated, sometimes overlapping and sometimes not communicating and coordinating the work as we should. So in a way of working at more globally, we always try to think of globally and still act locally, but the thing globally is still up there. So the 5 principles of the Paris Declaration are ownership. The country should have ownership as opposed to donor-driven programs. There should be a harmonization of all the different approaches, development approaches in the country. If UNICEF is there, USAID is there, what they're doing in child health should be harmonized with what the country is doing. Alignment of policies, their emphasis on results, visible, accountable results, even whether they're good or they're bad, we should be able to account for our results and we should be able to learn from them. And finally, accountability. There are different standards. For instance, this is a quick summary of what we have been discussing in the previous years. We've been looking at, for instance, different attempts of advancing ownership, like having the 3 ones. You may know from UNAIDS that the importance of trying to make sense of all the different stakeholders working HIV/AIDS, they agreed on having one plan, one coordinating mechanism, and one monitoring evaluation in each country. So the 3 ones, we don't know to what extent the 3 ones are being followed. And also the idea of having plans that are based on the country's national health plan, the idea of having budgets that are known, that the budgets shared their estimates for the following year, so the country knows how much money is going to be and they can allocate that accordingly. And the use of the donors' use of existing systems and mechanisms. We also talked about different ways of harmonizing and different ways of also achieving greater accountability and also greater coordination. We always say that there are 8 million children that die of preventable conditions. What about if there were just 100,000 CBOs, community-based organizations, working in a coordinated way and each of them preventing and being accountable for preventing at least an average 80 deaths each? Or there's still, the jury's out about whether there's 300,000 or 500,000 women die of pregnancy-related conditions every year. And what about if we had 1,000 NGOs, each one being accountable, prevented 500 deaths? How can we work in a more coordinated way to achieve these global goals? So with that in mind, this year we're going to advance the discussion with your help, and we're going to also circulate a sheet so you can write your name and email address so you stay in touch with us and participate, and next year we'll get together again and see how we move the agenda forward. Okay? So with that, I'm very happy to introduce Juan Carlos Negrete. Mr. Negrete is currently the chief of party of the Bangladesh Smiling Sun franchise program, which aims to expand availability of sustainable health services through a vast NGO-based network of 323 static and 8,630 satellite clinics and over 6,300 community health workers. Mr. Negrete is a specialist in health service delivery, marketing, communication, and business, and with more than 32 years of experience. With that, here's Juan Carlos. Give him a big hand.
Thank you, Elvira. Well, perhaps, first of all, good morning. Thank you very much for being here. I'm really happy to be on this side, sharing with you this experience. This is going to be a little bit off as an experience as compared to many others that you might hear today. And the reason it is off is because the organization I'm going to talk about, while when I was doing the preparation, I realized that the principles, the Paris Declaration, was perhaps thought out with nations as a frame of reference, a nation state as a frame of reference. So government is a main figure when talking about the principles that we were going through. Smiling Sun, it's a social franchise, and it's the only social franchise in healthcare that you find in Bangladesh. It has, as Elvira said, 323 static clinics of two kinds, one basic and another one that is a comprehensive obstetric care unit. And think of it as concentric circles. You have the static clinics. Then you have an outer ring of satellite sites. Those are 8,600. It's a vast, vast network. And on top of that, or an outer ring of community service providers that provide services in the community, mainly in rural communities. Those are women who canvass the areas where they work in and provide basic access and referrals to the basic access to services and referral to the clinics. Well, this network, and here's where the whole thing starts then, and to make sense with the Paris Declaration. This network complements, was thought out to complement the government of Bangladesh public sector network of service delivery, which is vast, is big, however, it's limited. In Bangladesh, 14% of the services they provided, or better said, the population that public services provided is only 14% of the total. 86% is through private providers. And we could consider Smiling Sun as a private provider in this context. So you start seeing here a little bit of certain things that have to do with the whole Paris Declaration. So yes, there's an ownership, no doubt, and it is important that the government of Bangladesh acknowledges Smiling Sun as one of its own. So that was one important aspect, and mainly when in the last round of the development of the new plan, the new health plan, it's called the HPNSSP. I could finally say it, which is the next 10-year plan for the healthcare structure in Bangladesh, that only is planning for that 15% that we were talking about. So it was important that during this planning session, NGOs and particularly Smiling Sun was acknowledged as one of the elements that the government would like to consider in its overall strategy. The idea here for Smiling Sun is, of course, to expand access to health services, and mainly those services that are not widely available. In Bangladesh, there's a huge debate about the maternal mortality ratio. It goes from 320 to 570. That is a huge gap, and you can understand how it stirs a lot of heated and not so friendly discussions. Well, the fact is that only 12% of Bangladeshi women deliver a baby in a healthcare facility. That is the fact. And we know that there's a correlation between delivering this setup and, of course, maternal mortality ratios. That has been known for a long time. Well, Smiling Sun is helping the government of Bangladesh to provide safe deliveries, and to a point that it has accumulated 50,000 safe deliveries without a single maternal death. So I knock on wood, because you never know when it's... But the truth, so the point here is the accountability issue and sharing this information with the government is very important from two perspectives. One, it's yes, we're accountable for those women who come and we serve them and we have to provide our best in order for them to get what we are trying to deliver. That is one. But it's also important for the government of Bangladesh to know that the network that is serving, that is complementing them, is providing services of this kind with these results. So they can use it as a benchmark. our motto when we have these discussions with them is, it can be done in Bangladesh. In Bangladesh, you can actually reach these standards of care. So that is one aspect that I wanted to comment here, and how it is related as an effective aid within the frame of the Paris Declaration. So it has pushed, like in a dance, both the government and Smiling Sun to share data in a very constructive way. Now, for the first time in more than 20 years, the government of Bangladesh has reported the data of Smiling Sun as its own. Said, okay, this is part of our integrated, our holistic view of what the health system should be. And I think that is the most important example of this kind of collaboration. That we were happy to consider that the government was thinking of Smiling Sun as its own. Now, the ownership, let me go back to this point. The ownership is not a simple concept. Right. Can you imagine, when you share the same toy with two kids, you have an issue of ownership. Right? Well, here's the same. You're talking about a budget that people can think, hey, I can use this budget for whatever purpose. Sometimes with high objectives in mind, and sometimes with a little bit more pedestrian objectives in mind. But the idea is that sharing the information has always a risk. So you have to share this information and create the sense of ownership with the government and with the NGOs that are helping you to achieve the objectives that you have set for the organization. And so the other element that I thought that it was important for us to consider within the frame of reference of the values that you saw in the Paris Declaration was certainly the alignment. And one of the things when I started reading about the Paris Declaration and I was talking about they were talking about the homegrown systems, I said, well, perhaps this is a little bit nonsensical. But then I came to realize that the process is at the end dialectical, because you have your own concepts. It's not their own concepts or your own concepts, and any of these have to be imposed. It is just a flow of knowledge. At the end, what we have today, assistance delivery in Smiling Sun, is not exactly what we thought we would impose at the end, that we were bringing with us at the beginning, nor what the government had. So there has been a process of transformation. So now what you can see is that there is, of course, a system that belongs to Bangladesh, that belongs to the network, and has elements of, it's a syncretic system. It has elements from what we were bringing as the donors and what the local society was expecting. And here it brings me to the other point of the Paris Declaration. It seems that it's very macro. When you're going through this, you say, okay, I mean, who doesn't like macroeconomy? It's kind of, you see these variables and it's relatively easy to go through it. But the issue is that healthcare service delivery has both macro and micro. And the microeconomical analysis is as important as the macroeconomical analysis. So for us, it was very important to develop certain concepts that could be appreciated by our network and by the government at the same time. And those concepts were three: leadership, culture, and structure. We had to share a concept of leadership within the network, and the government could use it as a reference or not. But at the end, the government had to negotiate with that structure that had been created. So there was a sense of a culture of quality of care, a culture of service, a client-centered culture that we thought was not there at the beginning, or based on our preliminary analysis and our formative research. So the idea of creating a concept of client-centered services was new. Just to give you an example, when we were talking about the health record of the individual, what our counterparts in the government were saying, hey, well, the health record is ours. That is information that belongs to us. So, no, actually, the information is not ours. Actually, it belongs to the client. The client has the right to have access to that information. So some of you could have a smirk about this and say,
Sure.
Yes, it's true. So that is telling you that these issues of leadership, culture, and structure are essential. Now, also because you struggle with both the conceptualized and this macro concept that has been discussed by Easterly and others, and saying, okay, perhaps aid is reaching a certain point in which you start facing decreasing returns from it. But the truth of the matter is that if you break the analysis into two dimensions, the micro and the macro, you might see different results here. So let me get back to the micro analysis. Well, we actually check on our aid indicators. So we have been able to arrive to a certain figures. We know today, for instance, that providing a service to a woman in Bangladesh or to anyone who comes to a clinic for that matter costs 20 US cents. Now, if we take into consideration how much they pay, this is reduced to somewhere around 15 and 16 cents. So that is a way to measure and to compare. How does it cost to the government of Bangladesh to provide the same set of services? Well, actually, they still don't know. But we can be used as a frame of reference for them, too. So that one is taking me to the other element of how do we share this information with the government of Bangladesh. We have created certain venues for a constructive dialogue. One of them is what we call the Program Advisory Committee. We invited the government and others, not just the government. Remember, this is not a government effort. This is a societal effort. So we have invited the government and others to come and tell us, hey, how do you think we can further work with you? So we get these ideas. We believe it enhances ownership. It has also the accountability issue. Then there we raise certain expectations, and then while addressing the sense of ownership, you start addressing accountability, and then you have to start managing expectations. That is part of that is the nature of the beast. But it has been incredibly rewarding because it has helped us, for instance, to identify areas for expansion of services. I don't know, many of you, you're not familiar with, many of you, I'm thinking, are not familiar with Bangladesh. I may be absolutely wrong. But Bangladesh, for those of you who are foreigners, is like having the population of Brazil or Russia in half of Ecuador, which is this, perhaps one of the smallest Latin American countries, or half of the population of the U.S. in Iowa. So, it's the fifth most densely populated country in the world. And I always say, actually, it's the most densely populated country in the world, because when you compare, the others are San Marino, Vatican. So those are city-states, so that is not entirely true. So it creates its own challenges. So that country has an area that is almost not populated, which is called the hill tracts, close to Burma. So the government encouraged Smiling Sun to set up services there. So we went, and we were happy to share those experiences. Here you see now the government is considering this organization as one of its own. So just to come to an end, for us was important to summarize, to create the sense of ownership, to align our efforts with government efforts and other stakeholders, to establish a close relationship with the government and our stakeholders, to measure and share what we have found. And sometimes that requires, and that's tricky, because sometimes you don't like to share what you have to share for many reasons. I mean, sometimes you think, should I actually tell them this? And then you say, okay, I have to be consistent. Perhaps I have to tell them this because I started telling them before. And the other is, the accountability and the creative tension. And let's not be naive. The interests of the organizations are also determined by the individual interests. And you will find that some people is in alignment with the higher goal and others are not. That is part of our business. But finally, to close with the concept of the Paris Declaration, I think what is important in this sense of accountability of aid investment, what it is important is to consider, or the governments can consider, and also donors can consider, is that these are like reservoirs of ideas. If we only invest in one set of of actions, if we think that only investing in the government, our aid, might be the way to go, you might be not looking at many things that are happening on the side, that if this crop with this single seed fails, then there's nothing that we can resort as a reservoir. While having other investments, other interventions going on simultaneously that you can count as effective, and you have to measure them as well, if they are not just cut them, can serve as pockets of knowledge that can be shared later on with those governments and with the donors alike. So bottom line is, we believe that this intervention is cost effective because of its own nature, I mean, just the sustainability and looking for that, but also because it was centered in certain principles that were not common or in some instances we thought antithetical to what we're with our counterparts. But at the end, it resulted in a joint intervention and in an association that has been very productive for the country. And we believe that the results will finally show up in the next DHS. So that's it. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Juan Carlos. So that was an example about aid effectiveness and accountability in the private sector that then can be shared with all the other stakeholders. The next presenter is going to be Mr. Ray Martin. He is the director of Christian Connections for International Health, and he is an advocate for closer collaboration between global development institutions and civil society, including the faith community. Ray Martin serves as the executive director of CCIH, as I said, cch.org, a network of several hundred organizations and individual members promoting international health and wholeness from a Christian perspective. He has 45 years of experience as an international development and public health specialist, managing the design, implementation, and evaluation of large health and population programs. Here's Ray Martin.
By the way, there's more turnout than I expected, so I have almost enough, but if a few of you can share.
Can you mail them?
Oh, yeah, I can certainly email copies, but if a couple of you sitting here can share, or sitting beside each other and can share, that would help. Well, this is an interesting subject. And I wish I would have been at the first three sessions on aid effectiveness that Elvira organized, but I don't know what happened there. But I think we can have an interesting discussion here, especially at a time when my USAID employer, my former employer, which was USAID, and then I worked at the World Bank for a while too, so I have experience on the donor side. Now I'm learning a little bit about what the relationship issues are on the other side, being with a small NGO and with many of our members who also are looking for grants from USAID, World Bank, and other donors. What I would like to do in these few minutes is first talk a bit about the importance of the faith sector in global health, and then to talk a little bit about some aid effectiveness issues, some with a long-term perspective, and then some with a more current perspective. First of all, I think it's important for us to understand, and many people actually do not realize, how big the faith sector is in global health, in organized health services in developing countries. I have here one of my favorite indicators is that a common estimate used by WHO officials is that 40% of health services in sub-Saharan Africa are provided through through faith-based organizations, mostly Christian hospitals, Christian clinics, Christian public health programs, but not exclusively Christian, But it just happens that most of the faith-based organizations are Christians. We work in interfaith settings as well, even though, as Alvira said, that our network, which grew out of the Global Health Council, is a network of Christian organizations and individuals. In fact, I see a number of CCIH members here. So in sub-Saharan Africa, the faith-based infrastructure in health services delivery is huge. In other regions, I won't go over the whole thing. Even in India, where only a couple percent of the population is Christian, I think the latest count is that there are about 600 Christian clinics and hospitals throughout India. So it's a major subsector in global health that we're talking about. Now, and one of the reasons I want to point that out is that if we're looking or thinking about aid effectiveness globally, we can't think only of big donors, what big donors do, and what government does, because a significant proportion of health services takes place outside of the government sector, and often not related to anything that USAID or the World Bank or WHO does at all. So I want to be sure that we're aware of the importance of this faith subsector as we think about the topic of aid effectiveness and accountability. Now, another thing, I've never talked about aid effectiveness specifically for FBOs, faith-based organizations, before, but as I was pondering on this, I was thinking of a factor that I think Elvira will be delighted to hear me say. When we talk about aid effectiveness, we very often think about this project, this 3-year project or 5-year project that some donor has, and then the grantee or the contractor does a baseline survey at the beginning of the project and then an end-of-project survey. And then we compare all the supposed improvements in whatever indicators we've chosen and then measure that against inputs and costs, and then we get some idea of aid effectiveness. Thinking of a very short, project-oriented kind of relationship between the aid donor and the aid recipient, if you use that old terminology. Well, I would like to suggest, thinking about faith-based organizations, looking at developing countries, certainly in Africa, but this is true in much of the developed world. If you look at the history, you know, the 100 or 200 year history of the evolution of the present-day health systems and the kind of institutions that are part of the modern health sector, and the kind of strategies and the underlying principles that are that explain the way these health systems operate, and the human resources apply, and the relationship between the institution and the system and the population and the patient. I think it's fair to say, one can debate this, but I think it's fair to say that much of this is really a legacy of faith-based missionaries going from the West and establishing relationships and building institutions in developing countries around the world. Now, I'm willing to debate that, and I'm making sort of a rather broad-based assertion here. But I've lived in many overseas countries, and I really think that one can make a credible case, and one can rebut it also, but one can make a credible case that much of the present-day health system and health technology and so forth is in some respect or another a legacy of this long-term relationship between the Western world and the developed world. I'm using some loaded questions here, so I'm willing to debate this afterwards. And I think that one can make the case that even though these relationships of Christian missionaries or other religious missionaries going to wherever and building relationships with local populations, even though they probably didn't conceptualize that as aid at the time, it really was, in a sense, bringing material resources and human resources and new ideas to local situations where they didn't exist. And over time, and we're talking about not just a 3-year project or a 5-year project, we're talking about decades of relationship that much of the developed world has adopted many of these concepts and technologies and so forth that were brought from the West in efforts initially launched by faith-based missionaries who were going not so much, I mean, motivations varied. Some of them we might affirm and some of them we might not affirm. But part of the package was introduction of new ideas and new ways of organizing health services and new technologies. So I would submit that this long-term relationship between Westerners and the technologically advanced and scientifically advanced world and the developing world, often initiated by faith-based missionaries going for whatever their motivations were, is an excellent example of aid effectiveness. Okay. Another example is that the initial impulse from these missionaries was to bring clinical services, hospitals. So there are a lot of stories about the early hospitals that were developed by faith-based organizations around the world. But I would also like to suggest that it was very often people who were motivated by faith, missionaries, and sometimes local people who had faith-oriented motivations for what they were doing, were also among the first to discover that the clinical, an exclusively clinically based approach and a hospital-based approach was really not the most effective way of improving health status of whole populations. And there's a fantastic story, at least for those interested in faith-based organizations, a fantastic story about how some of the early efforts in the 1950s and 1960s to develop strategies that involved not so much people coming to the hospital or clinic for service, but developing public health services and various kinds of public health interventions that were taken out to the population, engaging communities, engaging the population in the health enterprise, that it was many of these Christian organizations, usually Christian, not always, that learned that we needed to have a new approach in order to really have a population-wide impact. And it was some of those earlier experiments, like in India there were a couple, there's one in Latin America, another one in Asia, I believe, one or so in Africa, that eventually became, they were well documented, and there were measures of accountability and impact, and they became the basis for WHO's eventually adopting the strategy of primary health care, culminating in 1978 in the Alma-Ata Declaration. There was a very interesting article in the American Journal of Public Health, APHA's journal, several years ago written by a man named Litsios that examined this history of these early sort of pilot, usually missionary, conceived, community-oriented, community-based approaches to public health that that made the case to people in WHO that this was a more effective approach in having a population-wide impact on health status than the older emphasis on clinical services and hospitals. So I would suggest, again, here's an example of, I don't know whether you want to call it aid effectiveness or not, but there is a certain, I think, it's somehow related to aid. It involved relationships over a long period of time, over many, many years, that ultimately had an enormous impact on outcomes, both institutional outcomes and laying the foundation for much improved indicators in global health. Now, let's think a little bit about the situation today. Most of these faith-based organizations now are nationally run, nationally financed, although there's still, in many cases, some continuing interaction between these local institutions, the hospitals, clinics, whatever, and other stakeholders. You know, it may be a small grant that continues to come from the so-called mother church, or it may be a government subsidy. In Africa, where I'm most familiar, quite a few of the African governments provide some subsidies. They provide drugs, or even may pay the salaries. In some countries, they pay the salaries of the staff of these faith-based organizations, or provide training. So there's still a lot of interaction. USAID and many USAID-funded organizations, World Bank projects, and so forth, continue to provide funding to many of these faith-based organizations. But do we have a feel for how effective this kind of continuing aid is? Well, unfortunately, most of these faith-based organizations do not do the best job in sort of measuring impact and being able to provide data that show the effectiveness of this aid that's received from the local government or from an outside donor or for whomever. The experience varies widely. There are all kinds of faith-based organizations. Some of the U.S. organizations that I'm familiar with are just small mom-and-pop kind of operations that want to go somewhere in some province of Kenya or something and do good. And then there are other very large ones like Catholic Relief Services or World Vision or Samaritan's Purse or some of these organizations that are really state-of-the-art NGOs, faith-inspired non-governmental organizations that really do have fairly state-of-the-art systems for gathering data and being able to report to the donor or the partner, their other partners, what their impact is, as well as to demonstrate effective use of resources. But very many of them are faith-based organizations at the local level are often small, very small organizations, churches or mosques or whatever, who are doing some good community-oriented public health work, but do not have systems in place that measure very well either financial accountability or impact. And so one of the challenges, really, is trying to provide support and training and developing simple models for measuring effectiveness that are within the capacity of these small, locally run organizations to actually implement. But I think one can say that it's pretty generally perceived by both populations served and by donors that faith-based organizations are probably at least as effectively run and are as at least as good an investment as, say, government or other providers. So that, in a sense, I guess I would say that that is some sort of subjective measure of aid effectiveness that's generally, but not always, fairly positive. I think that the lesson for now as we go forward is in these continuing relationships between these faith-based organizations, whether it's an international faith-based organization like World Vision, or whether it's some local activity that's managed out of the local church or out of the local mosque or temple or whatever, that we should continue to work at this effort to try to help build capacity for them to manage resources in a more transparent, systematic sort of way, as well as to work with them in developing realistic but implementable indicators that help them to measure what impact that they have, so that as time goes on, we have a better idea of the effectiveness of this kind of relationship between outside stakeholders and the local implementing faith-based organization. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ray. Now I have the pleasure to introduce Barry Carlin. Barry Carlin began his public health career with a BS in environmental health from UCLA, followed by an MPH in environmental health and health education from USC Berkeley, and a doctor in public health from the University of Michigan. He served USAID in rural Thailand for many, many years, and as a family planning advisor for the Population Council and New York and Pakistan for 3 years, and health education advisor in Papua New Guinea for WHO for 4 years. He has consulted in dozens of countries, and in addition to his APHA staff, he was staff at APHA for 80 years. He has been associate professor of global health at the University of Colorado for 4 years, and now he is the chair of the Boulder chapter of Healthcare for All Colorado. Here is Barry.
Good morning. Thank you all for being here, and thank you, Rivera. I'm going to try to do something a little different today. I'm going to try to take two models and compare them and ask what explains the differences. And I'm going to go to a couple of extremes. Forgive me if the selection is biased. I've selected Thailand because I perhaps know it best. I spent 6 years there. And in contrast, we're going to look at Haiti. In Thailand now, 98% of the people of Thailand, rural and urban, enjoy clean water. In Haiti, the figure claims to be 58%. I'm not sure how accurate that is, but there's a difference. In terms of sanitation in Thailand, 98% of the Thai people have clean sanitation, usually flushed systems, hand flushed or the kinds that we're used to here. In Haiti, that figure is about 19%. In Thailand, for every 1,000 children under 5, 21 die. In Haiti, it's 72. The life expectancy of Thais is about 70 years. The life expectancy of Haitians is about 61 years. The routine vaccinations that people in Thailand get come mainly from the government, over 90%. In Haiti, close to 0% comes from government health services. How do we explain those differences? In Haiti and Thailand, both enjoy wonderful climates, good soil. The people love their children. They want them to survive. There have been years and years of NGOs and other services going into both countries, and yet the outcomes are vastly different. When I arrived in Thailand in 1959, I was a naive young man out of Berkeley. I didn't know much about Thailand. I didn't know that missionaries had come to Thailand in 1838 and introduced vaccinations and anesthesia, ether. I didn't know that the Prince Mahidon had introduced hospitals and supported nursing schools and clinics in Thailand decades and decades ago. I knew that the people were suffering from every communicable disease you can imagine, from leprosy to tuberculosis, of course, and malaria, and in more recent years, HIV, AIDS, and the other diseases, as did Haiti. And what happened was that the government of Thailand decided health was a priority, and it had its government support for that priority from the kings of Thailand through the elected officials. And so they started with the cooperation of USAID, a village health and sanitation project in the most vulnerable and the poorest area in the Northeast. And in those days, USAID people were stationed in the bush, and so I spent the first 5 years in Northeast Thailand, Korat and Khankhen, and worked with the Thai people. But the project was headed by Thais, not me or my colleagues in Bangkok or in Washington. They designed the project, they determined where they wanted to go. And we started because the Thai people felt it was important to look at making clean and convenient water accessible to the people. So we started with engineers and health educators, and we designed a new pump and did hydrological studies. And also, at the same time, knowing that clean water isn't enough, the best of clean water will only protect you from 1/3 of the diarrhea. You have to address also the sanitation, the hand washing, health education issues. So in its wisdom, the Ministry of Health decided to focus on water and sanitation. And we did it by organizing village health committees, mainly women, but some men, women who were respected but not necessarily educated. We included teacher, include the headman, you have to do that. But it was mainly village women and men that decided what was important to them, where the well would be, how we would train people locally to who would start out and get the first latrines. We designed a brand new latrine, a squat plate, hand flush, water seal latrine that cost $1 in materials. We taught local people how to build it. Our original idea came from a report from WHO, Langwar and Warner, I think it was, describing a very crude model of the same thing that had been developed in India. These technologies turned out to be very appropriate. People loved them for reasons you wouldn't believe. There was no germ theory. There were no words for germs. That was important knowledge. The first thing USAID did was to bring in an anthropologist for a number of months, Robert Texter, bless his soul, from Stanford. And he went around and asked about what words people use to describe illness, disease, how important was it, what they thought caused it, how you could prevent it, what perceptions they had about the importance of this kind of behavior or that kind of disease to themselves, to their family and their communities. That became a basis of knowledge for developing a training program and a training manual written in Thai, later translated into English. Okay, that effort from the ground up started a national healthcare system because we were training local people. Right now, if you go to Thailand, you will find 800,000 trained village health volunteers, one for every 10 rural families in Thailand. They're the backbone. The doctors may think they save lives, but these are the people who really save lives. They're trained to identify high-risk pregnancy, to make sure all the children are immunized. Everyone now has a cell phone, and every Thai villager is within a half an hour of an ambulance. And they did more than that. Once the water and sanitation program succeeded and people were happy, they then expanded into maternal and child health, nutrition, and other issues that were of concern to them locally. I mentioned water and sanitation succeeded for reasons we didn't expect. It wasn't the germs. that we were protecting them from in the water. The people wanted convenient water, where they, the women mainly wouldn't have to walk miles to fetch water. So we were able to drill wells and put up little storage tanks, et cetera. That was important. For latrines, again, human waste had nothing to do with disease in Thailand, the way Thai people thought. But it smelled bad. They didn't want open pit latrines. They didn't want their fields covered with human waste. And when we introduced something really modern, a water flush latrine using either pond water or wastewater or their well water, they thought, wow, this is really modern. This is great. We want to put them in front of our houses, not in the back of the houses. And so those things spread like crazy. And finally, at this point, merchants saw that there was a market there, and now the government doesn't make any of these things because you can get them for a couple of bucks from any hardware store in Thailand. So those things were popular for reasons you didn't expect. When we designed the latrines, we didn't know if the people would like them. We took them out and said, here, try them out. And the women didn't like them. Why not? The angle we had made on the bowl caused splash onto the woman when she urinated. She didn't like that. So we got the feedback right away, and we changed the angle. It was not a problem. And as I say, this went very well. Now, a government came in a few years ago and realized that Thai people really appreciated health services and wanted, and he offered, Thaksin Shinawat, the prime minister, offered free health services to every Thai citizen for 30 baht, 75 cents. And it turned out it was more expensive to collect the 75 cents than it was worth, so it's now free. Good quality, basic health care services to all Thais. And no one's going to take that away. When you talk about sustainability, regardless of government change, no one's going to take that away. The Thai people built that themselves, that system. They treasure it, and they're going to keep it. Okay, that's enough about Thailand. Let's go to Haiti. Haiti's an entirely different story. Haiti was colonized hundreds of years ago by the French in a brutal history. I wouldn't want to describe it to you. They brought in 700,000 slaves from Africa. They despoiled the land. They cut down the wood in order to build plantations of sugar and other products. The wood they took back to France as ballast and to sell the products. In the 1700s, there was a revolution in Haiti, and the Haitian people overthrew the French colonialists, one of the most remarkable revolutions ever, and it's not very well known in the world, but they succeeded. But all that history of brutality, top-down decision-making, resulted in the kinds of governments which were quite different from what we talked about in Thailand, where villages were empowered to develop their own care, their own services. There's never been a strong government in Haiti which was there to offer services to the people. Let me give you a quote. Jean-Claude Duvalier. Here's what Duvalier said. Foreign industries of the sort that I want, Duvalier, come here only when you give them dirt cheap labor, no unions, and low taxes, a mindset that you will not find in Thailand. Sure, there are huge differences between the haves and the have-nots in both countries, and it's getting bigger as it is in the United States and many other places in the world. But the Thai people had a sense of service and community. Perhaps Buddhism was a factor there, although I don't want to denigrate Christianity in Haiti. It's a different set of mindsets. And so the question we have to ask ourselves really is, what model is appropriate for the nations of the world? We as Americans came to this country to escape government, and so we are suspicious of government. We don't want health care by government, death panels from government. Thailand was not like that. Thailand, the Thai people really honor their leaders, especially His Majesty and the royalty of the country. So you have to take in consideration, what I'm trying to do is point out how history really matters. And as health workers, if you go into a country, you really need to know the history of the people, how they think about health and how they think about their government. The fact that no one gets immunizations from the Haitian government says something very important to us, and we have to give that thought when we go in. But in terms of what our goals are, I believe for real sustainability over the years, our goal should not be strong NGOs that stay there forever. The NGOs, I think, and our government should be working to empower governments to do the kind of thing Thailand has done. You can't do it in every country. I know that certain countries can't do those things easily, but that's what we should work toward. And I don't accept this idea that, well, the Haitians are too corrupt. America has just gone from 23 to 49th on the scale of transparency in the world. We're going down. And I don't think we have any right to point our fingers at countries because they're corrupt. They do it in a different way. In Thailand, it's tea money. In Africa, it may be 10%. In Indonesia, it was 10%. In America, we call it TARP. We call it redistribution of the people's money to the wealthy. And a huge fight if you try to get tax adjustments here so that people pay a fair share on their Social Security, on their Medicare, on their taxes in general. So these are the issues I wanted to raise. They're a little different from what you might expect it when you invited me, but I hope they're provocative, and I thank you very much.
Thank you. That was great.